KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The writer and scholar Jay Michelson says if you look around in political campaigns and religious sermons, you'll see a theme developing, that religious liberty is being threatened in American culture. Michelson wrote a report about it. In fact, he says there is a well-funded, well-organized campaign being conducted by Christian conservatives that comes in response to what seems to be the growing support for gay rights and same-sex marriage. Michelson says they're reframing the debate, and he says misleading people into believing churches will be required to conduct gay marriages, for example. Today in the program, we're talking about religious liberty, and what Michelson says is a strategy conservatives are borrowing from the past, the same words and phrases from the old culture war repurposed for today. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Texas Senator Ted Cruz is using the language of religious liberty in his presidential campaign. Not so long ago, Utah Senator Orrin Hatch said federal judges were hostile to religion. Senator Mike Lee has filed a bill that protects people and organizations from religious discrimination by the federal government. And you're also hearing concerns about religious liberty from the pulpit of churches around the country, including the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints here in Utah. Today in the program, we're talking about this theme of religious liberty and whether it is, in fact, being threatened in American culture. The scholar Jay Michelson says, well, this is a strategy. In fact, just the latest strategy by religious groups and by political conservatives to combat same-sex marriage and the growing acceptance of gay rights. Michelson is joining us today. We invite you to join the conversation as well. Jay Michelson is a scholar and an LGBT activist. He wrote a report in 2013 called Redefining Religious Liberty, The Covert Campaign Against Civil Rights. It was published by the progressive think tank Political Research Associates. Michelson is currently a visiting scholar at Brown University. He writes a political column for the Daily Beast. He's the author of a number of books, including God versus Gay, The Religious Case for Equality. And Jay Michelson is joining us today from a studio in Tampa, Florida. Jay Michelson, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
I wanted to begin with a point that you have made. We'll get into the particulars about what you see as this campaign, this well-funded, organized strategy as we go. But one of the points you've been making is that, in fact, this is not an old argument. That it's not a new argument. It's an old one. It's something that's being repurposed from the past. Let's start there, if you would.
Sure. Really, the present moment is deja vu all over again. When the civil rights movement had its successes in the 1960s, and the consensus, the national consensus, really shifted on African-American civil rights, the religious right, although it wasn't called that then, kind of fell back to a strategy of claiming exemptions from civil rights laws. In fact, one of the most famous sort of desegregation-style cases about the Heart of Atlanta Motel was about a restaurant owner who said that he had a religious objection to seating whites and blacks together. And so even though the Civil Rights Act forbade that kind of segregation, he should be exempted from that law based on his very sincere religious belief. That kind of argumentation continued for 15 years, really wasn't resolved until the 1980s, involving a case with Bob Jones University, which had a race-based admissions and then housing policy and lost its tax exemption as a result.
Yeah.
So we've seen this before. We then saw it a second time in the 1980s and 90s around conscience clauses. So the first conscience clauses were quite narrow. So a doctor, for example, who had a religious objection to performing an abortion would not be required to do so. But now conscience clauses are so large that they include entire hospitals and huge organizations which can claim to have religious consciences to not provide abortion, but now also, thanks to the Hobby Lobby case, not provide coverage for contraception either. So we've seen this before.
Mm. Well, I wanted to add, the Conservative Heritage Foundation issued a report last spring looking at religious liberty in this marriage debate. And I wanted to mention a couple of the issues that they're talking about. There were a lot of issues focused on wedding service businesses, for example. One in particular, a photographer in New Mexico who had declined to shoot a same-sex wedding. And the Human Rights Commission in New Mexico found that this person had discriminated based on sexual orientation. The case went to the Supreme Court, declined to hear it. But there were other cases, in a flower shop in Washington State and bakers in Oregon and Colorado and other businesses trying to, I guess, express their religious sense of all of this and coming in conflict with the law. So you're seeing, a similar kind of thing in these cases as well, I suppose.
Absolutely. And we should be clear that there is no question that any minister or clergy member of any kind who has a religious objection, whether it's to marriage or anything else, would not have to perform any kind of religious ceremony. So, for example, a Jewish rabbi who doesn't believe in intermarriage between Jews and Christians, nobody would force that individual to perform a mixed faith wedding. What these cases are all about are businesses, though. These are folks who hang out a shingle and are in the public marketplace and say that they don't want to play by the same rules as everyone else. And that's, I think, a crucial difference. It does go back to the Bible, that we render unto God what is God's and render unto Caesar what is Caesar's. The marketplace is governed by the rules of Caesar, right? The rules of the secular republic, the secular state. And one of those rules, in the case of New Mexico, has to do with non-discrimination. You can't have a business and put a sign on the door saying no blacks allowed, no Jews allowed, no gays allowed. It just doesn't work that way in America. And even if you have a religious objection to photographing an interracial couple or an interreligious couple or a same-sex couple, if you want to play by the rules of the marketplace and own a business that's out there as a public accommodation, that's the legal term, you have to play by the same rules. And so I think there was a fascinating concurring opinion in that New Mexico photography case by a very conservative judge who I think really wrote a wonderful opinion saying that he really understands the sincere religious objections of this. It's a husband and wife photography team. But that, just what I said, when you open a business, you have to play by the rules that govern the marketplace, not the rules that govern your own private conscience.
How do you explain, because I'm hearing a lot of it around Utah, obviously the capital of the Mormon Church. I'm hearing a lot of it. I'm also seeing concerns among evangelicals and religious people throughout the country talking about, in Utah, for example, this constant refrain that it won't be long before or it's possible that the church will be forced to solemnize gay marriages in their temples or in their churches. And you hear the same kind of refrain. You just pointed out that that's not true, that's not a concern, but people are talking about that as a concern. Why do you say that is? Because you do write about the fact that there's this concerted public relations campaign that's in fact what making that case.
Yeah, I think that's a very cynical, scaremongering campaign. And I can give you a very recent example from this week. There is a for-profit wedding chapel, really just a business where people go to get married. It's across from the town clerk in the town of Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. And this is not a religious establishment. The people who are there have one of those, mail-away ministries where you can become a wedding officiant.
Right.
They ran afoul now, because there is now same-sex marriage in Idaho. They got a note saying you'll need to perform all weddings, all legal weddings, not just opposite-sex ones. They didn't really file suit, but a large, very well-heeled advocacy group, the Alliance Defending Freedom, filed suit on their behalf and headlined it as follows: "Government tells Christian ministers, perform same-sex weddings or face jail and fines." Now, that is a completely irresponsible headline for that's their own press release talking about the lawsuit that they filed, because it sounds like the government is telling something to Christian ministers. Really, what the government was telling the local government, the town government in Coeur d'Alene, was telling these two for-profit wedding facility owners that they have to obey the non-discrimination law and they have to offer their services to whoever comes to avail themselves of them. So that's an example of the real scaremongering that's taking place around this issue. And I think it's tapping into something that is a real fear. It is the case, as we've seen in survey after survey, that Americans are becoming less religious, that there is a waning of traditional religion. This is outside of Utah, actually. Mm-hmm. It does not necessarily include the LDS Church specifically. Yeah. There's been a decrease in the religious affiliation rate of Americans. And so there is that. That's a real phenomenon. But what this campaign is doing is tapping into that real fear and really exploiting it in what I consider to be a really cynical way.
You also mentioned that they're reframing the questions of discrimination as questions of religious liberty of those who wish to discriminate. They're sort of switching, reframing. This is part of the strategies as well. I want you to talk about that, if you would.
Absolutely. It's an easy way to think about it is that religious liberty used to be a shield, and now it's being used as a sword. The original religious liberty cases were almost always about people in minority religions who were being persecuted by the majority. So, for example, you know, the famous case of the Jehovah's Witness who didn't want to recite the Pledge of Allegiance, didn't want to salute the flag. So that's a minority religion and a majority secular practice that was abridging that individual's religious liberty. And that was a shield. Nobody was telling that the Jehovah's Witness student wasn't telling everyone else what to do. They just said, I don't want to say the Pledge of Allegiance. You know, now, flash forward several decades, religious liberty is a sword being used by the majority against the minority. So now, for example, in the Hobby Lobby case, which brought to the public what a lot of us in the kind of think tank community had been worried about for years, the Hobby Lobby case said, well, okay, if you have a religious belief, you can impose that belief on someone else. You can, as the owner of a closely held corporation, say, I'm not going to provide this particular health benefit, even though I'm required to by law, because I have a religious objection, which happens to be a majority religious objection, a majority religion, obviously, in this case. And then I can kind of impose that on someone else. Or likewise, if we take the photography case, which a lot of folks think is a difficult case, I'm not so sure it's that difficult. These are individuals who are out there in the marketplace who have, I don't doubt at all, their sincere religious convictions, which they're fully, of course, entitled to, and they have to have whatever religious beliefs and practices they want. But they're out there in the marketplace saying, because I have a religious belief, I'm going to discriminate against you based on that religious belief, and I'm going to let it be known to everybody that your marriage is second class or that your life is second class, and I'm going to broadcast that message, and I should be protected in doing so.
What does the precedent of the Hobby Lobby case say to cases like this? Because as you've mentioned, it extends obviously beyond the questions of contraception, those kinds of things. And I imagine it has some relevance to the same-sex marriage case.
Absolutely. It's directly relevant. Really, we should see these two phenomena, Hobby Lobby and the new, you know, the recent Supreme Court non-decision on same-sex marriage, as two sides of the same coin. And the two have combined in really an explosive way. I think Hobby Lobby woke up a lot of more left-wing progressive folks to the issue of religious exemptions. This was kind of one of those, you know, wonky inside the beltway concerns for a while. And now it's not. You know, I think we've really seen that this is a real issue, and it's a real campaign that's taking place. And so I think opponents of religious exemptions became really emboldened by the Hobby Lobby case. And just briefly, one example of that, there was an Employment Non-Discrimination Act in the House, in the Congress, that was going along quite well, but had a pretty broad exemption. And actually, all of its backers dropped out over the summer after the Hobby Lobby case because they felt that the exemption set a bad precedent. You know, and then the second side of the coin, this recent decision on same-sex marriage, has now emboldened the proponents of religious exemptions. So because they feel that now with same-sex marriage, there's a stronger need for broader and broader religious exemptions. So, you know, right in Utah, State Representative Jacob Andrig, if I'm pronouncing that right, has said he will reintroduce an extremely broad religious exemption regarding marriage. And so both sides, I think, have really gotten riled up around this issue.
Let's back up a little bit and talk about what you describe as, in your report, as the nerve center for all of this. A law firm called the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty, based in Washington, D.C., And they're really, this particular organization, there are others, I'm sure, but I guess they're front and center in this campaign.
Yeah, there are a few now. I think the field has broadened. The organization I mentioned before, the Alliance Defending Freedom, which used to be called the Alliance Defense Fund, they actually have brought a number of successful cases on the state level, like the case in Idaho that they've just filed. And the Beckett Fund in D.C. and the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, which basically kind of shares staff sometimes with the Beckett Fund. What this movement is a kind of a small nerve center of very right-wing conservative Catholics. These are the same folks who stopped the bishops from making any statement about divorce, for example, in the recent Vatican synod that just took place, that are kind of creating an intellectual nerve center for a larger movement. You know, I think a lot of folks felt that the so-called Christian right had really lost its way after the 1980s and 90s. It wasn't as big of a force. The Tea Party became more important. The LDS Church became more prominent, certainly in fighting same-sex marriage and Proposition 8 in California. But actually, I'm not sure that that's true. I think the Christian right has just retooled. So what we're seeing is a very small group of conservative Catholic intellectuals who are morally opposed to any form of birth control, certainly abortion, any legitimation at all of sexual and gender diversity, homosexuality, same-sex marriage, anything else, kind of trying to find a new way to fight the old war. And as we said it right at the top, they're using an old playbook, religious exemptions, which worked for a little while in the issues of race and preserved segregation, and worked until the present day in the case of birth control and abortion.
Explain how the framework works, because you say that it's not based on moral grounds, that it's more based on sort of legal issues or their perception of constitutional questions. So it's that's the strategy, not making it a moral point, but making it a legal one, I guess.
That's right. And, you know, I think the if you look at the issue of same-sex marriage as an example, I think again, I'll keep using the phrase Christian right, religious conservatives really learned their lesson. Some of the people who were out, I was out, you know, on the streets in the 90s and the 2000s on this issue. And the people who you'd see on the other side were, you know, they just weren't really that photogenic. These were people who were shouting obscene things and carrying obscene pictures, and they were waving their Bibles in people's faces. And it just became really easy to see the other side, so to speak, as motivated by hate. Right. And I think that was always bad optics. So they've learned their lesson. Now, religious liberty is a value that everyone supports. Right. Liberals support religious liberty. Conservatives support religious liberty. Who could be against religious liberty? And the cases that they're bringing and the sort of the poster children for these cases are much, much more savvy and careful than what we saw in the last 10 years. So let's go back to that example of the wedding chapel in Coeur d'Alene. You know, this is a mom and pop operation. These are two people who I don't doubt that they have a sincere religious objection to same-sex marriage. And it's kind of a close case. It's one in which you could really see both sides. You don't want to compel individuals, especially because it's not just freedom of religion, but also freedom of speech. We never want to compel someone to say something that they don't believe. You never want the state to come and tell two individuals or, you know, who are operating, even if they're operating a business, you have to say X, even if you don't believe in X. That just runs afoul of our constitutional principles. So they're using close cases like that to score much bigger points and to make much broader points to scare people into thinking that religious liberty is really under attack. But you're absolutely right. This shift in tactic, it's not just moral to legal. It's the faces of the movement. And it's moving from very relatively unsympathetic fire and brimstone kind of extremists on the one side to now, you know, folks who look like reasonable people, the photographer, the wedding cake baker, and in this case, the for-profit chapel owners.
Well, so I guess the idea, the strategy, if it is that, in fact, is that you just appeal to a broader base. Some of these arguments get intellectual respectability, you say, among liberals. It's getting traction.
Yeah, it's intellectual, but it's even more than that. It's popular. I think this is really a mass-oriented movement. And what are the arrows left in their quiver, right? I mean, same-sex marriage, it's remarkable how quickly it's shifted, not just legally, not just judicially, but really in terms of popular acceptance, you know, which now is somewhere around 55% of Americans favor civil same-sex marriage. And that includes a lot of folks who are opposed to same-sex marriage in their own religious communities, and they get the difference. They understand that people have different views and that the government shouldn't be deciding which religious view is correct. So this is, you know, it's kind of a fallback argument, and it's also an argument that retools the opposition in a much more media-savvy way.
I wanted to ask you about something you write I think it's in the introduction to your report, that this is not just about winning religious exemptions to the law, but to, here's your quote, contest the authority of secular law itself. That seems pretty big. What do you mean?
Well, that's absolutely right. And, you know, if you follow some of the organizations, connected to the group called The Family, for example, which Jeff Charlotte wrote a fantastic book about a few years ago, kind of a somewhat secretive right-wing religious organization that has senators and congressmen in their membership, or folks who were at the conference held right near me in Florida called The Gathering just a few weeks ago. These include a lot of organizations who believe in things like Christian Reconstructionism or believe that we're in the end times. And it sounds far-fetched, but actually, if you look, and this isn't a secret. This is all in publicly available documents. It's not a matter of interpretation. It's what folks believe. There really is a strong feeling that the secular law or the secular state is less valid than many of us believe it to be, for one reason or another. And you know what happens when you have one set of laws that govern most of us, and then another set of laws that govern some of us, is that the rule of law itself is weakened, right? If you go to a hotel, for example, a small B&B, and you go to the door, and right there on the door it says, no blacks allowed. Well, you know that civil rights may be the law for some, but it's not really the law, right? It's separate and unequal. It's not something that we really believe. It's not something that has real validity, because people can opt out of it if they want. And that's what's happening. That's what would happen now with some of the broad religious exemptions around same-sex marriage. Well, it's the law, but not really. And actually, the law itself doesn't apply to everybody, because all you have to do is say you have an objection to it, and then you can weasel out of it. I think that's a real threat, and it would represent a real change in how Americans understand the very notion of the rule of law. And I'll just one last piece on that. Again, no one disputes, if you think about it as concentric circles, the narrowest circle there in the center, no one would dispute religious exemptions for churches or for ministers. And even the next level of the circle out, maybe religious schools, right, or organizations that are essentially religious, even if they're not churches. And then it gets a lot more gray as the circle grows larger and larger. So, well, religiously affiliated organizations like a Catholic hospital, well, that's close, but not certain. It gets kind of gray. Then it gets even to for-profit corporations with Hobby Lobby. Well, that's quite an expansion, right? There are way more for-profit corporations than there are religious churches or schools. And then finally, when it gets to any individual, so you go to the town clerk and you want to register your marriage, and that individual can say, well, I'm not going to do my job because I have a religious exemption, that's when it gets to really erode respect for the rule of law.
Let me ask you, before we head to a break, because you mentioned just how active funds like the Beckett Fund are and how organized they are, highly active and well-funded. How well-funded are we talking? I saw a report that you... from the Beckett Fund, I think this was from 2010, what was it, $2.6 million in revenues. Where's this money coming from? How well-funded do you mean?
Well, that's, you know, the Beckett Fund's $2.6 million is just a drop in the bucket. We're actually looking at the entire kind of architecture of the Christian right being closer to $1 billion a year in total funding if you take all of the different organizations. What's fascinating, and I just wrote an article about this in the Daily Beast, is that it's actually a relatively small group of funders. Believe it or not, some of the same rules that have allowed super PACs to flood our airwaves with negative ads, which is certainly true here in Florida as we head into the gubernatorial election, those same laws are allowing large foundations to mask their donors. So there's an organization that I doubt any listeners have heard of, the National Christian Foundation, which is certainly an innocuous, positive-sounding name. What that really is, the NCF is actually a donor-advised fund that doesn't have to release the names or of the donors or the amounts that they're contributing, and has invested massive amounts in this religious liberty, religious exemptions movement. They're only one of the funders. There are some of the usual suspects who are also funding some of the Tea Party, for example, the Koch brothers. It's not well reported that the Koch brothers are not only kind of secular pro-business libertarian funders, but have also put an enormous amount of money into social issues and into far-right conservative organizations. So this is a huge amount of money. And, I worked for the leading foundation that funds LGBT equality issues in the United States that is responsible, does about $17 million a year of grant making. And we're looking at just at the NCF at hundreds of millions of dollars on the other side. So there is this perception of, I don't know, the gay lobby or something like that. But if you follow the money, it's much more on the far right conservative side. And again, this is not just your kind of mom and pop, religious folks who might be a little more conservative or moderate on the issues. These are folks like the Beckett Fund who are really on the hard right, or the Alliance Defense Fund, the Alliance Defending Freedom, that if you just kind of Google them and find out some of the extreme positions that they've taken on issues, it's really quite shocking.
That's Jay Michelson. He's the author of a report from last year called Redefining Religious Liberty, the Covert Campaign Against Civil Rights. It was published by the liberal think tank Political Research Associates. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about religious freedom, or this idea that religious freedom is under attack. It's something you're hearing a lot these days in political and religious circles. Here in Utah, we've heard it from Senators Orrin Hatch, from Senator Mike Lee. We've heard it from LDS church leaders as well. So we're talking about it. Our guest today, one of them anyway, Jay Michelson, who's with us now, has been talking about this as a strategy, just the latest strategy by religious groups and political conservatives to combat same-sex marriage or the growing acceptance of gay rights. Jay Michelson wrote a report called Redefining Religious Liberty, the Covert Campaign Against Civil Rights. He's joining us today from a studio in Tampa, Florida. Joining us also on the program now is Eric Ethington. Eric is a communications director for Political Research Associates. That's a liberal think tank that published Michelson's report. He's originally from Utah, we should point out, is co-founder of the blog Utah Political Capital. We should mention he's a former Mormon and is bisexual, based in Boston these days, joining us from a studio there. And Eric Ethington, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I want to sort of have you start. I want to talk about the relevance of this issue in Utah, particularly, of course, the Capitol, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. What is the Mormon Church's role in this larger story, this, as Jay Michelson puts it, this organized effort to promote this idea that religious liberty is being under attack? What's the Mormon Church's role as you see it?
Well, the LDS Church began at least their organized fight against LGBTQ rights back in the 90s in Hawaii with the battle over same-sex marriage there. And they were quite successful at it, joining a coalition of evangelical and Catholic churches where they kind of withdrew from the spotlight because their public perception in that state was not too favorable for them. And that was a successful strategy that they employed there all the way through 2008 with Proposition 8. But at that point, things really started to shift in America as a whole. And we have now seen them move into joining these coalitions to promote this redefined as Jay Michelson put it, version of religious liberty, where they are going to use this concept that most Americans hold very sacred, both progressives, conservatives, the religious, the non-religious, to spread this misinformed idea that religious liberty is under attack. And our position specifically with the LDS Church is that, yes, religious liberty is under attack, but it's not from progressives. It's not from secular people. It's not from LGBTQ people or non-religious people. It's actually under attack by religions like the LDS Church and Christian right organizations who are trying to take this protection for individuals and shift it to institutions where they now are the ones who get to define what rights, what civil rights people are going to have. So as a researcher who watches the LDS Church very closely, it's quite concerning because they are putting their own members at risk.
Do you have any sense at all about how much money the LDS Church might be spending on groups like the Beckett Fund, for example? I mean, obviously they don't disclose that kind of thing, but do you have any sense of that at all?
You know, because they don't disclose it, and I can't say for certain, I don't want to speculate, but the level that of their involvement is without question. The Apostle Elder Dallin H. Oakes actually just received a major award from the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty. He also sits on the board of another Christian right organization called the World Congress of Families that are all pushing this same concept. That would allow for any individual, private company, or public office holder, or just public official to be able to discriminate against LGBTQ people on the basis that it violates their personal religious freedom, which, of course, is a very dangerous idea that we have seen going back to the civil rights movement back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, where if you open the door for that one exemption, that then would allow the evangelical business owner to say, well, I don't want to hire LDS people anymore, or I'm going to fire all LDS people because they are not part of my religious beliefs.
Is Elder Oakes sort of the key figure, or certainly one of the principal key figures within Mormonism in terms of raising this issue, raising this alarm?
He has certainly emerged in that position, especially since 2009. We have seen speech after speech that he has given, both to private institutions, in general conference talks, where he has promoted this idea of their version of religious freedom, saying that if you are going to discriminate based on religious grounds, that should be allowed. And he's gotten very specific about it. I'm looking at a 2011 speech that he gave where he actually came out and named those examples you were talking about earlier, like the photographer, like the florist, saying that public accommodation laws should go out the window and you should be able to treat anybody however you would like, regardless of if it's against civil rights laws, just because of your personal religious beliefs.
I want to play an excerpt from one of his latest address at the LDS General Conference. This was just a few weeks ago. And a lot of people were paying attention to what he said and have suggested that they heard a conciliatory tone in Elder Oakes' address, that he said, okay, it looks like this is the way it's going. This was before, by the way, the Supreme Court had decided not to rule, but he clearly could see the writing on the wall, or it seemed to anyway, that this was the way it's headed. And as he said, I mean, a lot of people sort of keyed on this, that we should be civil. We disagree, but this is the way it's going. We should be civil. But you heard something else there, too. And I want to play this section. But you heard something that was less conciliatory. Is that fair to say in that address?
I would say so. It, you know, it branches into two different levels, where I would say his tone was certainly more pleasant. It sounded much better for LGBTQ people, and it was specifically about same-sex marriage, I think, where he was going with that, where, you know, perhaps he recognized the writing on the wall that, hey, if the church is going to continue to take such an active political stance, not religious stance, but political stance against it, it's only going to hurt them. And I definitely applaud him for that new tone. But he does also specifically mention the rights of religious individuals being maintained and furthering that redefinition.
In dedicated spaces like temples, houses of worship, and our own homes, we should teach the truth and the commandments plainly and thoroughly as we understand them from the plan of salvation revealed in the restored gospel. Our right to do so is protected by constitutional guarantees of freedom of speech and religion, as well as by the privacy that is honored even in countries without formal constitutional guarantees. In public, what religious persons say and do involves other considerations. The free exercise of religion covers most public actions, but it is subject to qualifications necessary to accommodate the beliefs and practices of others. Laws can prohibit behavior that is generally recognized as wrong or unacceptable, like sexual exploitation and violence, or other terrorist behavior, even when done by extremists in the name of religion. Less grievous behaviors, even though unacceptable to some believers, may simply need to be endured if legalized by what a Book of Mormon prophet called the voice of the people.
That was Elder Dallin Oaks at the last LDS General Conference. What are you hearing there, Eric Etherington?
Well, first of all, I would like to point out that very concerning tie that he makes with LGBTQ people, even if vaguely, it's still being compared to things like sexual violence and terrorism, which is obviously a huge problem for people who are listening. But he does draw there the specific distinction between public and private acts. I would definitely agree with Elder Oaks that in public, if you want to, you know, approach somebody on the street and evangelize to them, that's your right. You're allowed to say what you want there. The problem is when we start getting into corporations, or we start getting into instances of employers versus their employees, and starting to dictate your faith to them at that point. That is where we really need to be careful to draw the line. And not allow the civil rights bright and clear wall to be breached.
It's hard to tell how this is playing out among the leaders of Mormonism. Obviously, they're not being public about whatever disputes they may or may not have as to how to approach all of this. But there is some sense, Eric Etherington, that there's a bit of a divide among leaders, that you have younger leaders or leaders with a different kind of sensibility who are pushing perhaps for more tolerance of gay members and gay issues, and then you have others who want to, you know, hold the line, or a little more doctrinaire on these kinds of issues. Do you have any sense at all how that might be playing out?
I would say that the divide is definitely there. And as you mentioned, that's something the average LDS person never really sees is the debate between the general leadership of the church. But when I listen to people like Elder Dieter Uchtdorf speak, the tone in the message is very, very different. It's very open. It's very inviting. It's recognizing what religion is supposed to be, your sincerely personal held religious beliefs that you keep to yourself. Versus when we hear people like Elder Oak speak or Elder Packer or Elder Ballard, it starts to really cross that line where they are saying that they should be able to enforce those religious beliefs. So how that's going to play out, we're going to have to see. But unfortunately, it is those kind of hardliners, if I can use that term, that are enforcing the policy. And really are, I think, purposefully spreading this misinformation campaign. A great example is during Prop 8, where all of the websites that the LDS Church produced in California, under their banner, under their logo, registered by the church headquarters, specifically mentioned that LDS temples might have to close, that ward houses might have to close because if Prop 8 didn't pass, they were going to be forced to perform LGBTQ or same-sex marriages, which of course is not the case. And I think that the LGBTQ community would be the first ones to stand up and fight back if anybody ever did try to make that law. What this is really about is we have to level that playing field where the religious beliefs of every individual, you know, my religious freedom means that I am able to believe what I want or not believe what I want. That is the constitutional protection that needs to be protected at all costs, not the rights of institutions to force me to believe as they will.
We need to take another break, but I want to get Jay Michelson into this conversation just briefly before we get to a break. Jay Michelson, do you want to say something about how you're perceiving the role of the LDS Church in the in this broader story?
Yeah, I think two points. I think Eric really stated it quite well. There's a report that just came out a few months ago from the Pew Research Foundation that 25% of young Americans who are leaving their faith are doing so because of their church's teachings on homosexuality. That is remarkable. Right? These are not the gay people who are leaving. 25% of young people who leave are saying they're leaving because of this one issue. So I think the LDS Church, like others, other organizations in the American religious community, are recognizing that this has been a distraction, that this issue is not actually connecting with the consciences of the next generation, and that eventually church teaching is going to need to at least accommodate a more diversity of opinion. But in the meantime, absolutely, the LDS Church is still taking a real leadership role. The World Congress of Families, which is an international organization that has ties to the anti-gay laws in Russia and elsewhere around the world, they were planning to hold their annual meeting in Moscow this year. Next year, it's supposedly coming to Salt Lake City. Sharon Slater, who runs a similar but smaller organization, sort of a devout Mormon, and also out there in the international scene, not just fighting over religious exemptions as we're doing here in the United States, but actually coming out in support of criminalization of any kind of same-sex activity, the kinds of laws that we've seen in Uganda and elsewhere in the world. So she doesn't speak for the church, of course, only for herself, but the church itself and being involved in bringing the World Congress of Families to Utah next year is deeply troubling.
Jay Michelson wrote the report Redefining Religious Liberty, the Covert Campaign Against Civil Rights. He's a visiting scholar at Brown University. He's joining us today. Eric Ethington is with us also, Communications Director for Political Research Associates, also co-founder of the blog Utah Political Capital. When we get back from a break, there's some very particular questions we'll get to when we get back. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about religious liberty and what one of our guests today says is a strategy conservatives are borrowing from the past, the same words and phrases from an old culture war repurposed for today. Jay Michelson, author of the report Redefining Religious Liberty, the Covert Campaign Against Civil Rights. He's joining us today. And Eric Ethington also with us, Communications Director for Political Research Associates. Let's take a few calls. First from Gary, who's joining us in Bountiful. Gary, sorry for the wait. Welcome.
That's okay. Glad to hear your program, Doug. I'm wondering how the guests might explain how the Houston's HERO Ordinance isn't some indication of the kind of fears that the religious community has about the LGBTQ community exacting some pound of flesh for having suffered for so many years.
Jay, why don't you start with that one? And we should do we want to explain a little bit, Jay, what he's talking about? City subpoenaed sermons for their defense in a lawsuit against the Equal Rights Ordinance there.
Yeah, I think that's kind of an anomalous case. I definitely, I came up in the LGBT movement through the faith community itself. And I've seen, as the title of my book, The God versus Gay Religious Case for Equality indicates, I've seen religious folks really exercising their moral consciences in opening their minds and their hearts to their LGBT sisters, brothers, neighbors, uncles, aunts. So I think there's a false dichotomy between the two communities, between the between people of faith and people who are sexual or gender minorities. I don't think there's any payback that's coming. And I say this with firsthand knowledge of the large the large LGBT organizations, many of whom have people of faith in their leadership. I think the case of Houston's an outlier, and I can't imagine, and in my wildest nightmares, that any significant number of LGBT people are looking for any kind of payback.
They can't be helping that case.
No, but I think, there's a tendency we have to kind of take our eyes off the ball. You know, for example, when we're talking about religious liberty and persecution of Christians, there are a lot of Christians being persecuted elsewhere in the world. You know, China, for example, has 40 million Protestants and 9 million Catholics, all of whom are kind of a persecuted but tolerated minority. There's two recognized Christian denominations, and they're both kind of arms of the government. I think taking our eyes off the ball domestically here as well. I'll give you a similar case that may not seem similar at first. There was just a rabbi in suburban Atlanta who called for what he, in his words, a holy crusade against Muslims. Now, he says he meant only radical Muslims, ISIS and so forth. But, that's an example where there's something that's said in a place of worship that still could be, if there, God forbid, there actually were an act of violence carried out later, that could be subpoenaed, it could be looked at as part of the overall case. And I'm just being, being hypothetical here. And that's the extremity of what's going on in Houston.
Gary, thanks. Brandon is with us, calling from Salt Lake City. Brandon, welcome.
Hi, Doug. I consider myself pro-gay rights generally, but I read a quote in the newspaper which sort of set me at unease with the New Mexico cake bakers, and it was that they said, we would make this couple any other kind of cake they want. If they wanted a birthday cake or any other cake, we would make that. And I guess the reason that troubled me a little bit is because if I was a silk screener, if I owned a print shop, and someone wanted me to make a T-shirt that had an offensive slogan, racially offensive or otherwise, I would think that I would have a First Amendment right not to fulfill that order. So if the cake is off the shelf, then yeah, that seems discriminatory to me. But if it's something you commission of an artist, and they don't agree with the message, even if I don't necessarily agree with that, if I knew that couple, I would tell them to make that cake. But I'm less sure.
You're worried about the First Amendment rights of people like that. It's a good question. Eric or Jay, which one wants to take on that one?
I think, that is an excellent question. First thing to notice is that all constitutional rights, all the other rights, are always rights in conflict. So, for example, one set of rights versus another set of rights. So there has to be something on the other side. In this case, if there were a case, it would be a civil rights law. So you'd have to be a member, basically, of a minority to even bring that case, or for the government to prosecute on your behalf. So, for example, if there were someone, a white supremacist who wanted to say something racist and wanted you to bake that cake, they wouldn't have a case because white supremacists aren't a protected class under the Constitution or under civil rights law. So that case wouldn't happen. It only happens where there's a narrow protected class. So sometimes LGBT people, although sometimes not, certainly African Americans, other groups. So, there it does come in. Those cases are tough cases. And I think they're tough, especially because in the case of an artist or a solo wedding baker or something like that, they are both an individual and a business. And this came up in Hobby Lobby, too, which is a family-owned corporation. Really, you're operating a business when you're running a silk screen shop. But, the law recognizes that it's also an individual. And we never want to compel the speech of an individual, just as you noted. So these are the close cases. And those close cases exist. But remember that what we're now talking about are huge corporations, are secular justices of the peace, are people who are running businesses, and will they be allowed, will the corporations be allowed to exercise their own religious conscience? And that, I think, is a much, much larger issue than some of these admittedly challenging cases.
Here's and Doug, I would also point out for your caller, Brandon, that in the specific example that he named with the T-shirt creator, he's not talking about discriminating against a group of people. You know, he's not saying I'm not going to print anything for white people or for black people or for women. He's talking about a specific message. Whereas in the case of the baker, they are saying, no, we are going to cut out all LGBTQ people from wedding cakes. Well, if you're allowed to do that, then you have to allow the white cake baker to say, well, I don't make any cakes for black people. It's a, I think it's a very different different relationship.
Here's an email. I want to work through this as quickly as possible because we're running out of time. An email from Julie who writes, she says, I'm curious if you can speak to the a few of the arguments that I keep hearing that are used to support the idea or the fear that religious freedom is being threatened. And she mentioned some that we've already talked about. But one in particular, Eric Ethington, I'll let you talk about this one, is that rumor that the LDS Church is going to be required to marry people civilly before being sealed in the church. There's this rumor, in fact, in the Salt Lake Tribune, Peggy Fletcher Stack wrote about this rumor that's been apparently making its way through the internet that the church is considering all marriages will have to take place outside of temples first, and then they can be solemnized later as a way of adjusting to the same-sex marriage decision. The church has really said there's nothing to that. We're not sure what you're talking about. You want to say something about that quickly, Eric Ethington?
I would mention that, it's an absolute rumor. If they choose to do that, that is entirely up to them. There has never been a proposal or advocacy group from the LGBTQ community saying that we want to force religions to perform any type of ceremony that they disagree to. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about civil rights. But that very much plays into this idea that religious liberty is the LGBTQ community or the secular community versus the religious community, when that's just not the case. You look at the United Church of Christ in North Carolina, where their religious liberty law in that state made it illegal for them to perform same-sex marriages, even though they wanted to. The idea is to let religions choose what they want to do. They are, after all, a religion. But individuals and institutions and businesses, they have to comply with civil rights laws.
Jay Michaels, let me ask you this question finally. Is there a point when they you mentioned that it took until 1980, I think it was the Bob Jones case there, where they finally conceded and stopped fighting this issue. Is there a point when they just finally quit? And do you get a sense of when that point might come? You know, does it finally just go away? Does it finally just dissipate? Do you sense that at all?
Well, I hate to be an optimist, but I do think that if you look at past history, as relationships with between straight people and LGBT people become normalized. So you find out that your coworker is lesbian or gay, and it's just no big deal, and you get to know them as a person. And you know, these kinds of barriers of secrecy and of shame that we've had for decades start to fall. People realize that we're human beings and we're Americans, and we are have much more in common than not.
Jay Michelson wrote the report Redefining Religious Liberty, the Covert Campaign Against Civil Rights, joined us from a studio in Tampa. Jay, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Eric Ethington, Communications Director for Political Research Associates, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Doug.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.